You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orn Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 33 of the Book Talk Today podcast. Today, we are joined by Roger Crowley. Roger is a best-selling narrative historian with deep interest in the Mediterranean world and its surrounding area. And today, we'll be discussing his book, Constantinople, The Last Great Siege in 1453. Roger, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much, Alan. I'm delighted to be here. I can always talk about Constantinople.
Excellent. And I think it would be good to talk about my experiences with the book and history in general, because I reached out to you to come on the podcast, and I'd read this book, I want to say, about 4 or 5 years ago. Since a young age, I've always had an interest in Ottoman history and Byzantine history, and especially in that part of the world. Unfortunately, I haven't had the opportunity to visit Constantinople, now Istanbul, but this book for me was great, and it became a source of enjoyment to read and actually write, like I said to you in the email, some historical fiction around it as well. So I think before we get into the actual book itself and ideas around Constantinople, I think it'll be great for the listeners and anyone who's watching this to get an idea about what first drew you to history around the Mediterranean and around this theme.
The history of the Mediterranean is actually sort of like family history. My dad was a naval officer who spent a great deal of his life both in peace and war in the Mediterranean. And in fact, one of his ships is sitting off on the seabed just off Crete. And when I was quite young, about 8, my parents went to live on Malta. And this was an amazing experience for us as children, you know, at a time when you're kind of quite impressionable. My mother was very interested in history, and Malta is a fantastically interesting place. Also involved in Ottoman Christian warfare, of course, with the siege of Malta and so on, and prehistoric monuments, blue sea, warm sun, what's not to like, really? And so, you know, this started then, and I've traveled a lot since then in the Mediterranean, but after I left university, I spent some misspent time living in Turkey and in Istanbul. And this city made a very, very deep impression on me. It really, you know, it really got inside my head. And when I was thinking about this and reading about it, I realized that there was a very, very famous book written, I think, in the 1960s by Sir Stephen Runciman, the great Byzantine historian, about the fall of Constantinople. And it was interesting, but I realized that his take and interest in it was that he saw it, the main theme for him was that it was the death, the final end of the classical world, of the world of the Greeks and the Romans. And of course, now where we are in the 21st century, it's been repurposed by everybody, but particularly, I suppose, in some kind of part of the relationship between Islam and Christianity. And so it had a kind of a different meaning, and I thought there was a chance to look at it again and tell the tale of Istanbul, perhaps with a slightly different slant.
I haven't read that one, so obviously I can't compare and contrast, but it'd be interesting to read that one and then to compare it to obviously the one that you've written. So can you just talk about the significance that Constantinople had during that time, and obviously its place in history as being a somewhat fortress of sorts, and why both Constantine and Mehmet during that time really wanted to have control of it?
The city was founded in 324 by Constantine. I used to refer to it as the first Christian empire, but I was ticked off by an Ethiopian man who told me that actually the Ethiopians had beaten them to it by about 30 years.
Okay.
But this was the Eastern Roman Empire. These are Greek speakers who call themselves Romans, if you can get your head around that. And it was a huge presence in the Mediterranean world. Location-wise, Constantinople, which had its predecessors, is very well situated on trade routes north-south from Europe into Asia and camel routes down into the Levant, Egypt and so on, and east-west between the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. And this makes it a very strategic point. Its life, its longevity, I think, is down to two things, really. One is the defences of the city itself, and the other was its sense of Christian mission. The Constantinople's life is very much bound up with a religious life, the life of Greek Orthodoxy. And the length of the city, although that it was really in the front line of sweeping invasions, mainly from out of Central Asia, one after another. The Persians come here, the Russians, the Bulgars, Attila the Hun, they all sweep through this region. And Constantinople seems like a bulwark of the Christian and Mediterranean Christian world. And it was been there for so long that people really couldn't imagine the time that it wasn't there. With it came the title of the Emperor of the Romans. After the Western Roman Empire had collapsed, the Emperor of the Byzantine world had this very prestigious title which rung down through the centuries, and the desire to take this title was one which was going to resonate with the Ottomans. For the Emperor of Constantinople, of what was left of the Byzantine world in the 15th century, Constantine the 11th, he was looking back over this hugely long span of time of succession of Christian emperors, and for him his whole life was bound up with really being the man who didn't drop the ball. He felt the weight of history behind him. For the man who is going to confront him in this siege, Mehmet the Second, Mehmet, which we can talk about in more detail, was also obsessed with the notion of taking the title of the Caesars. And the title of the Caesars continued to remain important to the Ottomans in successive centuries. In the 16th century, Suleiman the Magnificent was dead keen to capture Rome, the heart of the original capital of the Caesars. So it had a great resonance throughout the world, across the whole of the world, really. And so this title and the prestige of the city had enormous presence across Europe and Asia, and probably as far away as India, actually.
The interesting thing for me when I was reading the book is, like, it was very much obviously a religious battle and a defense. So Constantine had his lineage in Christianity, and then Mehmet, obviously the rise of Islam and the jihad and trying to capture the city. But it almost felt like it was two individuals, one defending their lineage and one trying to expand their lineage. Would you say that was the case?
Yes, very much so. I think for Mehmet had strong personal reasons to need to take Constantinople. Mehmet saw himself as, and also he saw himself as an Alexander. Mehmet, who could speak Turkish, obviously he could speak Greek. He had the life of Alexander the Great read to him every day, and he perceived himself as the Oriental Islamic Alexander, whereas Alexander had come from the West and swept to the East. Mehmet saw himself as reversing the direction of conquest, but again, assuming the mantle of Alexander and seeking the title of the Roman Emperor. So there's a lot to defend for both people. It was very important when you became an Ottoman Sultan to legitimize your rule by a conquest. This added to your prestige. It also provided funds and booty to give out to your standing army. And every Ottoman Sultan, really from, you know, the middle, I suppose, of the start of the 15th century, needed to conquer something to expand the Ottoman world. And they saw themselves very much in an expansive mood. Christian said of the Ottomans, Ottoman conquest is like the sea. It never stops. Mm. It keeps rolling. And you had to legitimize your position by conquering something that you didn't have at the
definitely,
start of
the especially reign. If you're saying that you're God's vicegerent on earth. You can't just sit back in a palace and not conquest, if that's the case.
No, certainly not. You'll be in trouble very quickly. Because, of course, you've got a standing army, the Janissaries. And Ottomans had the first standing army in Europe. And these people have to be fed. And at a certain point, it can be like riding a tiger. Because, you know, if you don't feed the tiger, then the tiger will turn on you. So there are all sorts of internal political reasons why you needed to conquer something dead quick. And usually the funds from a conquest would go to building a mosque. So you couldn't build your mosque until you gained the money to do so.
Interesting enough, I want to talk slightly a bit about Mehmet's childhood and the death of his two half-brothers, because they were really the successor to the throne. And obviously his father didn't really see him as the successor. His father saw Ali, his half-brother, as his main successor. Can you talk about the death of his two half-brothers and the effect that had on him and perhaps shaping how he led and his mindset towards conquering?
Yes, his father, Murat, had three sons. No, there might have been one more. The whole deal with the Ottoman succession really was that you had a number of sons, and one of whom is going to inherit, and very often they have to fight it out. Mehmet was the third in line. The eldest died. Ali was the favourite son, and rather like, if you want to take an analogy from English history, the princes in the tower, mysterious tale. Ali and his sons, he was governor of a province, were mysteriously strangled by somebody, or somebody was sent to kill them, and nobody knows who it was. But it certainly wasn't Murat. It was not uncommon a bit later on for sultans actually to preemptively, because the sons realized that they were going to have to fight it out and all of them were going to die apart from one, you got to the point in the Ottoman Sultanate where sons would often carry out a preemptive strike to either kill their brothers or even to kill their father or to rebel against him. But this doesn't seem to have been the case with Ali. Ali was the favorite son. And undoubtedly the Murat was very depressed by this. What you did with your sons from quite a young age was to stop them becoming a threat to you and raising an army. You sent them off to govern distant provinces. So Mehmet was sent off to eastern Turkey quite young. And I don't think that his father clapped eyes on him until Ali died. And when he was the youth was produced in front of the Sultan, Murat was rather horrified by this rather unruly child who had to be beaten into submission. But so he wasn't expected to become Sultan anyway. And the upbringing of children was chilly in a sense. You know, you were separated from your mother. you were sent off under a leading vizier to some, you know, godforsaken outpost of Eastern Anatolia to rule, in inverted commas. And it was a lonely and slightly paranoid way of bringing out children, I would say. So Mehmet emerges really truculent, difficult, alienated. I believe he had quite a good relationship with his stepmother, because actually Murat did marry him, and this feminine presence was kind of quite important to him. But generally, growing up was a scary, difficult, and dangerous process. So by the time Mehmet reemerges, and he's going to be at the age of about 12, and he's going to become the Sultan, he's got issues, I suspect. And he's also, I suspect, because he wasn't the one who was destined to have this role, has got something to prove. He's got to prove himself. You know, nobody was thinking that this thirdborn was going to be the one, really. So he's got issues, I think.
I think it definitely added to the story, in the sense that he's probably got a chip on his shoulder, or he is trying to live up to the ideal that perhaps his father had of him, or the ideal that he sees as being a ruler. Because if he wasn't sort of destined to be that, you almost have to assume the role. So you have to kind of take on whatever that role has for you. So moving on a bit into the siege itself and the days and the events of it. One thing I wanted to talk about was the technological advancements during that time in warfare. So the Ottomans had the cast cannon guns, artillery wise, and also the Greeks and the Romans had Greek fire. So I wanted to ask you a bit about how the technological advancements in warfare affected the battles, and how that came to be for both sides, that level of technological advancements and the impact that had on warfare at the time.
I think that the Siege of Constantinople is kind of an iconic moment in the development of warfare. I mean, you know, no moment, I think, really ever is kind of like the watershed moment. But what we have to imagine about Constantinople is that it's got a perimeter of 12 miles. Two sides of it are surrounded by sea. And it has one land wall, 4 miles long, called the Theodosian Wall, which were built in the 5th century and kept out Attila the Hun, and kept out everybody else since, including the Arabs, massive sieges in the 7th and 8th centuries. This was a masterpiece of Greco-Roman engineering. It has three separate walls, effectively, an inner wall, an outer wall, and a moat, with killing zones in between them. It rears up about 100 foot. It's 200 feet deep, and it's got 192 towers. And nobody had the technology, the stone-throwing technology, to be able to crack this. So this is a formidable obstacle. We start to see the spread of gunpowder weapons happening at the beginning of the 15th century throughout Europe and into the Balkans. This was often the transmission by people who had been bell founders, who found a new, turning their plowshares into swords, into cannon casting. And the Ottomans seem to have got access to this technology around 1400, probably from their conquests in the Balkans. They got their metal by melting down church bells. Murat came to a siege of Constantinople in 1422 with about 20 cannons, and they did absolutely nothing, really. You know, they couldn't... There are two issues, really. One is, how penetrative is your cannon? The second is basically a logistical one. What you require to keep cannons firing is you need gunpowder and you need cannonballs. And somebody has, these are stone balls, somebody has to carve these, they have to create them to the site, they have to be carved to the dimensions that you require. Gunpowder is quite unstable. It's difficult to produce. So you're not really going to get the ability to bombard city walls with any great effect until you've managed the logistics of it. And we think of the Ottomans as being great fighters, but they were also incredibly good bean counters at actually gathering the stuff. And the organizational skills that went into the preparation for the siege of 1453 were extraordinary. First of all, they cast a lot of guns, and the core of this is one super gun that Mehmet had created. Again, this is an itinerant Hungarian cannon founder called Orban, and he comes to see Constantine and says, "I've got the technology to protect your city." Producing guns is very cannons is very expensive, and Constantine doesn't have the money, so he goes 140 miles west to Edirne, the Ottoman capital, and offers his services to Mehmet, and he promises Mehmet that he can create a huge gun that will bring down the walls of Jericho. I'm not quite sure whether how much Mehmet was into biblical analogies, but and there's a
References,
fantastic account of the creation of this gun, the casting of it in a giant mold. Huge amounts of bronze are required. It's 27 foot long. It has a diameter of about 30 inches and a stone ball that weighs half a ton. And they have a test firing outside the walls of Edirne. Women are told to stay inside unless they miscarriage with the firing of the gun. And it's all sort of slightly elaborated, probably, in the chronicles. But the gun is fired. The bullet, mighty bullet, travels across the countryside for about a mile and buries itself in the earth. And this gun, called the Basilica, the royal gun, is then going to be towed to the walls of Constantinople. And it's a psychological weapon as well as an actual weapon. Constantine is given advance information that this huge weapon of death is coming, and be very frightened. Again, the support corps of the Ottoman army is very effective. They had to build bridges across rivers. Huge teams of men and oxen to drag it. It travelled at about, 2.5 miles a day. It took them 6 weeks to get it to the walls. Alongside that, though, they were making casting a huge number of smaller cannons to use along. So they had little cannons and big cannons. They also were so well organized that they, n not on the scale, not on a scale large enough to repair or recast a giant cannon, but they had mobile cannon foundries where they could actually melt down and remake small cannons actually on the battlefield. So the technical skills, the Ordnance Corps of the Ottoman army is an extraordinary creation. And so this thing arrives in the spring, April, start of April 1453. They've got about 70 cannons of different sizes ready to unleash hell on the walls, the great walls of the Eternal City.
What about the Greek fire? Because I'm really interested about that, because it seems like the cannon itself sort of dissipated in history, like no one knows what happened to it, and it's the same with Greek fire, that technology was lost. And it seems like as much as this technology was created for this battle and for this siege, it almost seems as if it dissipated as well. All that information and how to build it, as well as the Greek fire, it seems to have just been lost in history.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I think people are still trying to work out exactly what it was composed of. I think it was a sort of naphtha pumped under in pressure cylinders. They'd used it very effectively. Certainly the first Arab siege of Constantinople in about 670, where they'd burned the Arab fleet with it, but it's slow and cumbersome to use. You've got to have these kind of primitive pump cylinders to propel it. I'm not sure. You've got to get pretty close, I think, before you can, I don't know the distance, but 20 feet, you've got to be pretty close. Incredibly frightening stuff. And there are tales from the Crusades of Greek fire being used by the Mamluks, the Turks actually, against the Christians, and men going up like wicks, just exploding, horrible, and very, very, very frightening. And the Byzantines certainly had and used Greek fire during the siege. We don't hear very much actually at the time about its technology. And I agree, it rather disappeared. I think partially once you've got propulsive weapons such as, handguns or cannons and so on, it's fairly useless. You've got to be very close to people to be able to do this. So the secret formula, I think, more or less disappeared, although it was widely known, not just in the Christian world, but also in the Islamic warfare manuals, up to that point. But it certainly does play a part, and there is mention of it being used in the up-close assaults of the city walls. But we don't hear that much about it, and it doesn't appear to have been that much of a factor in the success or failure of the defense of the city, I think.
I think it was just interesting in the fact that just comparing the technology and then seeing how it sort of, like I said, dissipated through time. And I don't know whether that's just the case when sieges happen and when cities go and information just gets lost in the process. Perhaps that's just part and parcel of what happens through time as information gets lost.
I think it does. I mean, I think I had a I was having a look at siege catapults actually for my last book, and people have found it very hard now to work out exactly how these things worked. And undoubtedly, they involve very high practical skills of, the length of the beam, the weight of the rock, the and so on. And but we have very primitive drawings of a lot of this technology. And I know that now, people have recreated quite a lot of this stuff, but when it goes, it goes. And people weren't terribly interested in it afterwards, I suppose.
In within the siege itself, so just going into a bit of detail, one of the things that interested me was the fact that Mehmet was able to maintain somewhat more of a morale of his troops and in battle than perhaps Constantine was able to keep the morale of his populace between sort of the dates. I think in the book he said the 24th and the 26th of May. Why do you think Mehmet was able to maintain the morale a lot better than Constantine was as an individual?
Mehmet came on the back of some very deep religious fervour surrounding Constantinople, which goes back to the two Arab sieges of the 7th and 8th centuries. They had actually been there. The point of, you could say that Constantinople stopped the advance of Islam into Europe for, a long period at these two sieges. They left behind the memory in the Islamic world of the prophet standard bearer Ayub died at the first siege in 670, and he was an important figure, and therefore an important martyr in Islamic memory. And along with this came a large number of probably rather apocryphal sayings. I think they're called the hadith in Arabic, about that the city will be taken, the glory of Islam will fall upon the person who does it. And this was disseminated, I think, throughout the call to the cause, and it certainly brought a very large amount of religious fervor with it, that this is a city where Ayub had died. that the mantle of the prophet was to be bestowed upon the conquerors of the infidel city. Mm. There are other factors there, though. The religion obviously plays a strong part on both sides, religious fervor. But Mehmet, again, he encourages people to believe that this is a very wealthy city, yep. which it wasn't nearly as wealthy as it had been. But alongside the spiritual dimension, there's the material, getting the stuff, really. And the idea that the Turks talked about, and in fact the Greeks had as well, talked about Constantinople as the red apple, this big juicy thing. Mm. A red apple attracts stones, I think is a Turkish proverb. And so there was tremendous enthusiasm for this, purely on the commercial
the
level.
War booties,
you can put it like
yeah,
that.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're going to do extremely well out of this. You cannot keep an army, though. You can't keep a large army outside the walls of a city for a very long time. And the one thing, the Ottomans always managed the encampment and the management of siege warfare, I think, better than Christians, because they were very good at camping. You know, they came
the Bedouins, though, aren't they? Yeah.
They are, yeah. And so they understood how to hygiene, digging latrines, organizing your tents properly. And they always said of Christians, encampments, they're absolute disgusting rabble of people and confusion and so on. So they're very well organized, but you can't keep an army there for a very long time. And it conventionally, and actually, of course, it's quite an early siege, it became the case that it had been the same, actually, with the Mamluks, who were Turkic peoples in the Crusades, that they didn't sit down outside city walls and just starve people to death, because people would drift away. They conventionally, the Arabic and Turkish sieges lasted about 6 weeks. If you can't take it in 6 weeks, then you give up. So they were always going for the quick knockout blow. This requires probably quite a lot of people to die, because you're at some point you're going to have to make a rush at the walls, and this is really where the morale, this mixture of religious fervor and material opportunity come in firing people up. But there are points within the siege when you can see morale start to slightly waver in the Ottoman camp. There was a point when they failed to prevent provision of Christian ships. About four Christian ships turn up, and the whole of the Ottoman fleet goes out to take them out, and fails. And there undoubtedly were moments, and we have very little direct first-hand correspondence, almost none, from within the Ottoman camp. But there was we have the record of a letter from the leading sheikh there saying, you know, look, if you don't get this thing together pretty quickly, the people will go, and it will be the shame of the Islamic world. So that's a configuration for the Ottomans. The Christians on the other side, it's different and very different. And how long have you got? But this is a deep religious story about the relationship between the Greek Orthodox Church in the Byzantine world and the Catholic Church in Rome. And in the 11th century, there was what's called the Great Schism, when the Catholics came along and excommunicated the Byzantines, which didn't go down very well. And these are people, they're two Christianities that are really divided by theology, very concerned about the wording of the creed, stuff which is difficult for us outsiders now to comprehend, but whether the Holy Spirit was descended from the Father or the Father and the Son, about whether you use leavened or unleavened bread in the communion, but above all about the primacy of the Pope, that the Pope was the was the leader and the authority of all the Christian world. And the Byzantines weren't having this, really. They believed that their Christianity was more authentic. And it's cultural as well. It's deeply cultural. When the First Crusade passes through Constantinople at the end of the 11th century, both sides were horrified by each other. The Crusaders by the fact that there were some mosques in Constantinople, because they weren't completely, there wasn't a complete barrier there. And on the Byzantine point of view, that these kind of ghastly, unwashed barbarians have pitched up, who apparently are Christians, who are ghastly people. So so what happens really is that the Great Schism becomes the problem as we approach the siege, because the Pope says he will not send support to help Constantine unless there's a submission to the church. And Constantine's not a theologian, he's a practical man, he's a soldier, he wants troops, and he's keen, and his father had been, his grandfather had actually, signed up to this. But a large part of the Greek Orthodox population are not playing ball. They refuse to enter the Mother Church, the Hagia Sophia, and so they're getting full-scale cooperation among the defenders is very difficult. And there was a certain feeling that some of the Orthodox saying, rather the Sultan's turban than the Cardinal's hat, you know, that, you know, thanks. We know that the Ottomans, one thing they were, is they were very, they allowed people to get on with their own religious life, effectively. They didn't particularly try and convert people. In some respects, from a tax point of view, it was a disadvantage. But so Constantine's got an incredible problem getting cohesion among his men, and coupled with the fact that he doesn't have very many of them. I mean, it's impossible. They're looking over the walls at this great sea of Ottoman troops and horses and tents and so on. Very difficult to count. Everybody would say there were 400,000. They might have had an army of 80,000, but how many of those were actually fighters, we don't know. But we do know that Constantine was actually able to count his men. It was 7,923 or something, you know. Really, there weren't that many. And quite a lot of them were Catholics who come for the cause from Europe, Venetians, Genoese, and so on. So the disparity of numbers, and there's no consensus of behaviour or of support within the city.
And you also
itself.
Said in the book is the fact that is when he was doing the census is a lot of them were untrained as well. So he said, make sure that this doesn't go out into the public and we'll just keep that for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, a lot of them weren't. And they were dependent upon some very efficient Genoese mercenaries, really, to hold the whole thing together. They had to keep quiet. They didn't want people to know how many men they didn't have, and they didn't want to know that, even though they didn't want people to know the men that they didn't have, they didn't want them to know also that half of them really hadn't probably ever picked up a bow
that
before
doesn't,
either.
That doesn't do great for morale.
So no, it doesn't. I mean, it looks pretty hopeless, actually, when you look at the odds. But, you know, Constantine was, you know, he wasn't, he saw behind him 1,100 years of Christian rule, an accession of emperors. He had the same name as the first Emperor Constantine. His mother's name, Helena, was the same name as the first Constantine's mother. And unfortunately, in a city that was given to prophecy, they were very superstitious people within the city. One of the many prophecies about this was that the city wouldn't fall until would fall under an emperor who was called Constantine, whose mother was called Helen or Helena. So the sort of cycle of the beginning of the alpha and omega of the life of the city is going to be people with same names.
So the siege itself, so about 50 days of fighting happened, and there was an opportunity for a voluntary surrender. And you've been speaking about the fact that he had a succession, he was Constantine the 11th, and he was sort of perhaps was going down on his sword rather than surrendering. I know there were three options he had. Can you just talk about how close there was an opportunity for voluntary surrender, because I know in the book you touch upon it, but you said that it's not clear how close he was, but what would have happened if he did surrender, or how close was that actually to happen?
I don't think that Constantine ever seriously contemplated surrendering. I mean, though yes, there were three options. He could continue to fight it out in an increasingly desperate situation. He could have a negotiated surrender and depart, and I think he was offered quite a sum of money to do so. Or he, the third one was for him to leave, because he was the iconic figure, and to retreat to the Peloponnese, which was still a Greek Byzantine territory, and live to fight another day. And probably the third was of the three for him was possibly the most attractive, in a way that he had. I mean, he'd been fighting to repel the Turks in the Peloponnese for 20 years. That was the whole of his background. So this was perhaps the most realistic possibility. I don't think they ever trusted the Turks, really, in the sense that the problem is, once you surrender, once you've opened the gates, you've got people out there who are uncontrollable, really. They will grab, they will, you know, they will, they, you know, they will plunder, they will slaughter. You've got no way of, you know, organizing an organized surrender is in this period is actually a non-starter. But he rejected all of them, really, because of his sense of duty, carrying the mantle of the emperors of Constantinople, and that he was prepared to go down to the last man to preserve that, rather than the shame of surrendering or of running away.
Yeah, it was interesting reading that, because there was no chance he was converting, because I know that was an option as well, which was interesting. That would probably have been the last option in that process. One of the things I actually wanted to talk about was his death during the battle as well, because obviously there is no account of his death as well. There is many different accounts of his death. He says some say that he got slaughtered or lost his armor, so they didn't know who he was, and then some others say they got beheaded, and others said he got crushed. What is the most plausible account of his death during that time, after the siege, and after Mehmet's troops sort of sieged
The
Constantinople?
two sides, of course, came up with different stories. The Turkish side is that he was caught running away,
Obviously.
and yeah, and you know that, and the Christian side is, so far as there is one. Well, there were two. There are two accounts, really. One was that he went down in the fighting. The other was that he got away and he became the kind of a sort of Arthurian figure who would return somehow. But I think that if he had been killed, the evidence would have been presented to the Sultan. His regalia would have been identifiable, I think. And there would be a massive reward for somebody who could pitch up with the head of Constantine. Bear in mind that when it came down to the final day, Constantine, between the inner and outer walls, he marched the remaining troops, 2,000 of them, into the space between the inner and outer walls and locked the gate behind him. So there was going to be no going back. So it's difficult. I mean, there's a kind of emotional hope that he didn't run away in a way, and it seems incongruent, really, I think, with his behavior throughout, that he resisted all opportunities to escape. So I think the most likely case. Most likely case is that he went down in the crush of the bodies, and was never identified. There's some issues around that because he would have had, I think he would have had boots with eagles on them, yeah, that kind of stuff. Somebody could just have plundered those, you know, without really kind of, you know, taken the stuff without really kind of thinking, some ignorant, you know, sort of Anatolian soldier who wasn't aware that this was a body, and just stripped the body of things that they thought were of value and interest and so on. So I think it's most likely that he just went down in the crush, actually. Yeah. And I think, you know, if the Turks had identified him and captured him and killed him, there would have been... Ottoman sultans are incredibly keen to have the heads of people. They want proof, you know. So they always like you to bring a head in a bag to prove that, you know, this is the man, we've got him. And that didn't happen. So I slightly discount the Turkish Ottoman story of that.
Also, the fact that a lot of the soldiers are probably there for financial reasons, that we've discussed, commercial reasons. So if they had come up upon his head or upon his body, they obviously would have had a hefty price on it. So to not declare that would have seemed a commercially bad decision, let's put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
One of the things I really wanted to talk about, just to sort of round off this this siege and this historical narrative, is the book seems, and the information seems so vivid. It seems to be described in such a vivid way. How did this information come to be, as someone like yourself who has studied this endlessly and obviously has read many accounts of it? How has the battle been described in such a way? Who was there on the ground that was actually recording it? Because as someone who is reading and interested about it myself, as a reader, you always come to question how the information came to be and how, you know, we're looking at 1453. So we're looking at, you know, just under 600 years or so. So how is that information passed down, and how accurate can you say that the depictions are?
Strangely, although it appears to be very well sourced, actually, the first-hand sources are really quite small. There are about a dozen, and some of them are good. There was a Venetian doctor there called Barbaro, who wrote a day-by-day account. Some of them are a bit more off the wall. The bloke called Nestor Iskander, who wrote a very confused and jumbled account, which is very interesting. The problem from a writer's point of view, I think, is that we have much more information, and this goes, I think, with a lot of stuff of this period that involves the Ottomans. The Ottomans didn't really have a tradition of narrative history, and they certainly didn't write first-hand accounts, you know. I was there yesterday, my friend Giovanni was hit by a bullet, God rest his soul. They didn't do that kind of thing. So when the Ottomans are write about the siege, it's really frustrating because this is their great event of Turkish history. And, you know, it's very flowery. The flower of Islam slew the cursed dogs of, you know, the infidel at the walls of felicity or something.
It's more poetic rather than a Daytona account. Yeah.
Yeah, I found, I suppose, their historical record was probably oral.
Yeah.
And I found a certain amount of oral history from post-period. But I had to work very hard. There's quite a lot of stuff that you can reasonably piece together from on the ground, actually, because Constantinople the old city is surrounded by water on two sides and the walls on the other side, and they're still there, and a lot of the buildings are there. The footprints of the street are exactly as they were in 1453 and probably as they were in about 500 AD. Yeah. You can assemble quite a lot of information about the land, the sighting of things. You can work out by walking the walls. You can see parts of the walls which are being degraded by gunfire. And I'm slightly distraught that in kind of the modern Turkish view of its history, they started to rebuild the walls, which I think is a terrible thing to do. So on the ground, there's a lot of stuff there that you can look at, and you can piece together, and you can see how it worked. You can see where people would have been. You can see the effect of the cannon fire. You can actually examine a certain number of cannons of this period and see exactly what they're like. The giant cannon is gone, but it's a lot of delving, really. I suppose there are some fair number of Venetian sources from people who weren't at the siege, but survivors' accounts that filtered back, which are reasonable. I do try to say whether stuff is disputed or not, without getting too nerdy about it. It's a very fine line, I think, between, you know, I mean, the chief siege engineer, the man called Giovanni Giustiniani, a Genoese siege expert, and a critical moment in the battle, he's shot. And there are about five different accounts of his death, including one that suggests that he was shot from behind because he wasn't very popular with some people. I think I give the five accounts, yeah, and say, well, actually, we don't know. It's a lot of spade work. There are fascinating gaps that we would love to know the answer to. I mean, a critical moment in the siege, Mehmet has ships hauled 1.5 miles over a piece of land into the Golden Horn to surprise the Christians. Yeah. And it's a pretty steep slope. And according to the records, I think they hauled 70 ships over the hill in one night. Now, this seems highly improbable, even given the large numbers of men they had. So what really happened? Did they do it? And if so, how could it not have been noticed? Because, you know, you've got to lay down a trackway. You've got to assemble lots of men. The defenders were taken by completely by surprise, and they looked out over the walls and saw these ships in the Golden Horn. Did they actually take the ships to bits and reconstruct them? There are records of people doing this, and we just don't know. And it was a very critical moment. So there are gaps, and I try not to go in for, you know, Constantine looked out from the walls with his pale blue eyes and thought,
God damn
Turks, that kind of thing. You know, there are one or two accounts. There was a really good account by a man called George Francis. In fact, there's two accounts by George Francis. One is a real one, written afterwards, which is very interesting, yeah, not terribly detailed on fighting. And the other one is a forgery, okay, about 100 years later. And so you have to own up to, you think, oh, I wish this was true, but actually all the evidence shows that this guy had a reputation for forging things. But he must have known quite a lot about it somehow. So you're ploughing through all this, saying, what can I sort of sign up to? What can I say because it's interesting, but say it probably isn't true, because, you know, the historiography of that is quite interesting. But I suppose because it was such a major event, and there were survivors who wrote in a reasonable amount of detail, and there were people who got away and told stories when they got to Italy. For the period and for a battle, its sources aren't bad. I mean, once we move into the age of printing, the whole deal shifts, really, because you know, a lot more stuff is recorded. But so I try to, I mean, what, you know, there's a lot of prophecy in this. There's this huge thing around lights being seen over the dome of Hagia Sophia, the mother church, and you know, this was God withdrawing his blessing on the city, and the most likely answer, which I did give, was that actually was a result of a volcano in the Pacific Ocean, which spread dust through the atmosphere, and so on. But it's a fine line, I think, between what you can categorically say and what you have to hedge around. And sometimes I'm very meticulous about making timelines, and sometimes you simply can't reconcile the days. You know, one person say it was that day, or there's a day missing or something. And I try not to disguise that, but it certainly requires a lot of digging. A lot of stuff about the actual fighting techniques are sort of generic. You know, we know the way that the Ottomans fought. We know the kind of equipment they had. And we know the way that they organized their armies in sieges from, you know, so material can be drawn from a longer period from the siege and reasonably be accommodated as being, this is the way that the Ottomans went about doing sieges. So it's a kind of a compilation of the best first-hand sources you can find, using them as scrupulously as you can, and then building around it information that relates to the period, knowledge of the city itself, And excuse me, while I just check my battery.
That's all right.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I hope you can cut. Knowledge of the city itself, and the fantastic fact that a lot of the monuments, you know, are still there, and that's extraordinary, really. So you can visualize, you know, you can stand outside the doors of Hagia Sophia, and these are the doors that were battered open by the Turks, and there are 10,000 people inside, and which is possibly an apocryphal number, possibly isn't, because it is actually a huge building. So you know, there's reasonable infill can be done around this. The castle that Mehmet built, a castle on the Bosphorus to cut off shipping from the Black Sea, that's still there, as is the castle on the other side. So there's a lot of on-the-ground stuff that you can reasonably draw on. But it's always a challenge, I think, and I think being scrupulous about the sources is important.
I think it's important, but I think, like anything, is you don't want to turn it into an intellectual paper, because most of the people who are reading it won't be... I want to say hardcore historians mostly. There'll be people who are interested in it but want to get some narrative as well, which I think the book did very well. It was obviously scrupulous in its history, and you admitted at times that, you know, these could be the possibilities, but we're not sure. It's interesting to debate it, but at the same time, you don't want to go too in-depth, because it's a narrative at the end of the day, isn't it? It's a story, and it's important to keep the reader interested.
I see what I do as being sort of like a bridge between academic research and the general reader, really. I think, you know, I'm very grateful for people who plow through dusty archives and, you know, publish stuff. And then I try and remain as scrupulous as I can to it while telling a story that will engage the reader. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Roger, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss your book, and to discuss Constantinople, the Last Great Siege in 1453. I mean, this book came out in 2005, if I'm correct. And what have you been working on since, just to give some sort of timeline, and what are you currently working on for anyone who's interested in anything that might be coming out soon?
The next book I wrote was almost like a follow-on from that, actually. It was about the Ottomans having reached the shores of the Mediterranean, being involved in massive Mediterranean warfare in the 16th century, and in a book called Empires of the Sea, which hinges around the siege of Malta, the capture of Rhodes by the Ottomans, Cyprus, and the mother of all slugfests in 1571, the Battle of Lepanto off the west coast of Greece, an extraordinary naval battle. I then, because in both those books, the Venetians, in both the Constantinople book and Empires of the Sea, the Venetians are entwined in every area of Mediterranean history in this period. Mm. I wrote a book about Venice as a Mediterranean sea power called City of Fortune. So I've basically written about the Mediterranean. After that, I made the mistake of going to have a drink with a Portuguese man who persuaded me that I needed to write a book about the Portuguese. So I had to leave the safety of the Mediterranean and learn about the Atlantic.
Okay.
And this is about the Portuguese first people to sail to India and really created the first sort of global empire, you might say. A fascinating tale in a completely different zone. Actually, in many respects, a continuation of that kind of contest between Islam and Christianity. Yeah. And after that, I went back to what was effectively the Turkish world, you could call it, the end of the Crusades, the fall of Acre, which is a city on the north coast of Israel now, the last stand of the Crusaders being besieged and annihilated by this Islamic dynasty, the Mamluks, who are actually Turkish people, who were using catapults before siege guns came along. Mm. So I've jotted around a bit, but ideally, I realise actually that I see 1453 being on the cusp of my comfort zone, because the sources for the Crusades are not nearly as good. There were Arabic sources which I had to get translated, but I really like, once you get into the era of printing, then you get far more sources. Yeah. Very quickly you get far too many sources, so it's kind of it's a difficult one. But that's what I've done, and I guess each book takes me about 3 years.
Okay.
It doesn't quite work, actually, because I'm not a natural linguist. But actually, if you really want to dig down into this stuff, you actually have to read the languages. Mm-hmm. And I drew the line at Arabic. I can plod through Turkish very slowly with huge dictionaries.
It's the Arabic grammar.
Are you an Arabic speaker?
We're Muslim, so we read Arabic, but it's more when you read the Quran and stuff. It's the grammar on top of then the language itself, and then the context of each word. It depends on its context in within the sentence. So when you're reading it, it's like, okay, that word is that word, but in the context of the
something else,
it means completely different. So that's why, for instance, our scholars spend, I don't know, 4 or 5 years in the religious school, just learning pure Arabic, because when when you study the language, it's not just it would seem like in English seems a bit easier to bring up. It's similar to somewhat Mandarin in the sense that you have different grammatical uses, and in Arabic you've like hamza and you have like different strokes, and it changes the definition of the word. So yeah, it's difficult to get your head around.
My Arabic translator, who's English, said, goodness me, I thought that word was dead dog, but it actually means catapult or something. You know, I mean, that's a facetious way of putting it, but you know, or some mysterious kind of Arabic saying, and then he writes, no, it didn't mean that at all. the word was, you know, something or other.
It's difficult to get your head around. Are you currently working on a book now?
Yes, I'm really following the Portuguese, who got as far as Malacca on the Malay Peninsula, into the Spice Islands, China and Japan.
Wow.
Meanwhile, the Spanish are coming round Magellan. It's really the joining up of the world, and there's a dynamic period between about 1500 and 1570, when Europeans, you know, in a sense, they joined up the world from both ends. The Portuguese, I mean, what they were really after was spices and contact with China. They're very heavily influenced by Marco Polo and, you know, the glories of the East. So in the end, it's really a tale of the Portuguese in China and the Spice Islands and the contest of the Spanish, Portuguese and Spanish, and they've divided up the world between them with some kind of extraordinary sense of proprietorial rights. The Spanish contest, really, for crossing the Pacific, which is, they spend years dying in on lonely atolls because it takes them ages to work out just how big the Pacific is. Mm-hmm. And it's when they finally get to Manila and establish a city on Manila that we really, the whole of world trade is linked together, because goods from China and Japan go from Manila to Mexico, then they're carried across the isthmus and then across the Atlantic back to Seville and so on. So it's a very dynamic, and it's a very dynamic period of exploration. Meanwhile, people in England are trying to find a northwest passage round Russia and are dying in freezing to death in the Arctic seas, and everybody's traveling actually.
What year is this?
So it's an interesting period. Well, my tale ends actually. My tale starts in 1511, which is when the Portuguese capture Malacca. This is a hub of the spice trade and the furthest point that the Chinese would sail to. And it ends in 1571 with the founding of Manila. And from there, it's called the Silver Way. We see silver being, the Chinese are hungry for silver, from the Americas going to China, and goods from China going from Manila across the Pacific Ocean and so on. And so this is the point at which the world is actually completely, sort of goes completely global, I think. When's that due? I hope you won't get to ask that question.
Unfortunately.
It's taken me a year to write the proposal. I still haven't quite finished it. It's very interesting, but it's almost at the point where there's a huge amount of printing in the 16th century. Some of it went into, the Reformation and, Protestant tracts against the Pope and so on. But a lot of it went into voyages of exploration. So there's a huge amount written in the 16th century and printed and spread across Europe. And I'm having to read a lot.
I can imagine. The exploration of the information seems to probably be the hardest.
Of the information is its own job.
Yeah, exactly. I can appreciate that. But very much looking forward to that. And once again, thank you for taking the time to speak with us about the book Into Constantinople. I look forward to read the other books. I haven't had a chance to get around and actually read the other ones, so I look forward to read those. And even perhaps having you back on to speak about some of that as well in the near future. That would be great as well. If you'd grace us with your presence again, I'd be very appreciative. Where's the best place that people can find you, Roger, to learn any more, learn about the books, learn about yourself?
Well, the best thing to do is to go to my website, which is just rogercrowley.co. If you just Google Roger Crowley, if I'm not a fishing photographer in Arkansas who got the .com, the rogercrowley.co.uk. If anybody wants to look in there, that would be great. If you want to read another book, people who have read Constantinople, I would suggest reading Empires of the Sea, which almost follows on exactly from it. Well, thank you very much, Alan, for your interesting question. It made me think deeply again.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you very much. With the podcast.
Thank you, Roger.
Yeah. Bye. Okay. All right. Thanks. Okay. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe for more content. Also, visit our website, www.booktalktoday.com, to subscribe and download the latest edition of our magazine. Join our mailing list to receive the first issue for free to get a taste for the value-packed content that we are offering. Book Talk Today, for readers, by readers.